We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
Lots to cover, starting with some updates on the situation with Referendum 71.
Yeah, this week, Referendum 71, there was some news about that. It was certified by Secretary of State Sam Reed, so we'll make the ballot for November.
Barely.
However, it barely passed the number of signatures required. He said it had 121,617 signatures, and they needed just more than 120,500 or so. And then the Washington Families Standing Together, the group that opposes Referendum 71, they went before a judge this week, and the judge in, I believe it was King County Superior Court, threw out the case and said that she couldn't hear the case because they needed to file it, Thurston County,
yeah, in Olympia, yeah.
Where Olympia is, because it's a state law that is at issue here.
Yeah, and the Secretary of State is the defendant in
yeah.
the case.
Yeah, and so she said, no, you're in the wrong court, which I think is interesting. I think the folks who brought the lawsuit should have thought about this a little bit ahead of time, because, you know, it costs money to bring a lawsuit, and you don't want to be wasting money by bringing it in the wrong court.
Or time.
Right, or time, because there isn't a lot of time between now and November.
I think actually it was strategic that they were trying to get it heard in Seattle because they thought it would be a more sympathetic court.
Yeah, but still. Anyway, so the judge threw out the case saying they needed to sue in Thurston County, and then by the end of the week they had filed another case in Thurston County to try to get it off the ballot, saying that Secretary of State Sam Reed counted signatures that shouldn't have been counted. The signatures at issue are ones that supposedly the folks who had signed the petition were not registered voters at the time they signed, although they became registered voters after they signed the petition. So there's some question whether those signatures should be counted. And in the case of some other signatures, the petitions, the referendum petitions that they had signed, were not signed and certified by the signature gatherer, as they have to sign a little affidavit on the back of the petition that says, yes, I'm the person who gathered the signatures, and yes, I adequately and accurately represented what the referendum is about. And some of those petitions were not signed and certified by the people who had gathered the signatures. So they're requesting those signatures not be counted.
And those sound like technicalities, but those that have actually been used by courts to disavow signatures in the past.
There's
also an aspect of that particular lawsuit that says that signature gatherers were misrepresenting what was on the petition and actually getting people who were in favor of the state law to sign the petition, which that's going to be a little harder to prove.
Yeah, that's going to be pretty hard to prove. But so that lawsuit is pending. It's interesting, the King County Superior Court judge who threw out the case said that she was sympathetic to the case. She just didn't feel it was the proper venue. So we'll see how they do in Thurston County. So there's some possibility that Referendum 71 won't make the ballot. We'll just have to wait and see. Another interesting development on that this week, too, was State Senator Ed Murray, who I think we talked about this last week, right, Jav, that some of the Democratic leadership here in the city of Seattle were urging him to run a write-in campaign for mayor of Seattle. And Senator Murray said, well, State Senator Ed Murray,
and no relation.
No relation, yeah. Said no, he wasn't interested in running for city of Seattle mayor. He would rather spend his time and energy working on getting Referendum 71 off the ballot if he could, and getting it passed if it does get on the ballot. And it's interesting, too, I want to talk a minute about how Referendum 71 is worded. It's worded in a very confusing way. The state law that Referendum 71 supporters are trying to overturn was passed recently by the state legislature to extend all of the benefits to registered domestic partnerships, generally people of the same sex, that married heterosexual couples have. And the supporters of Referendum 71 want to put this referendum on the ballot so that people who support the state law will have to vote yes approved on the referendum, and people who want to overturn that law, those who support marriage for heterosexual couples only and denying equal benefits to gay couples, have to vote rejected on the referendum. And knowing that people who don't understand or don't take the time to read the referendum that's going on to the ballot will generally vote rejected on a referendum that's on the ballot. So it's kind of confusingly worded. And Ed Murray said, you know, it's going to be a much better use of my time to educate people about what Referendum 71 is and to get them to support it once it is on the ballot, if it does make it past the lawsuits.
Yeah. It wasn't entirely altruistic on Murray's behalf, because there's also a political calculation there. And the political calculation is that, number one, it's almost impossible to win a mayoral race as a write-in candidate, even though he would have the backing of much of establishment Seattle, because they're really in a panic over both Joe Malahan and Mike McGinn, because neither McGinn nor Malahan owe their money and owe their base to the political establishment in this city. They both have independent sources. Malahan has largely been self-funded up to this point, and McGinn has an environmental base. So they don't need the political establishment, and of course Murray is very much a member of that club. He would very much like to secede Jim McDermott into Congress when McDermott retires, which McDermott has never said when he's going to retire, but he's getting up there in age, and you know, you would think it's going to be in the next term or two. Now, there's a lot of people who would like to succeed McDermott, because that's one of the safest seats in Congress. It's basically a lifetime sinecure if you want it. But if Murray winds up playing a prominent role and Referendum 71 is in fact passed in this case, meaning that it would ensure all but marriage for gay couples, then you would think that would make him be a much more prominent candidate for Congress in the future. So I think that was part of his calculation, not just that it had a greater benefit for more people, but that it would also be good for him politically if that campaign is in fact successful.
Yeah, plus running as a write-in candidate, your chances of success are very slim, regardless of who you are.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on across the lake over to the Bellevue School District.
Yeah, we had a completely unnecessary controversy going on in the Bellevue School District now. This is something that's been happening in the past couple of days all over the country, particularly in places like Texas and some red states, where conservatives are up in arms over a back-to-school plan by President Obama to have an address piped into classrooms to school children that would be from the President of the United States urging school children to, and this is a direct quote from the White House, study hard and get an education. Now, it's really kind of hard to imagine a less controversial message from a politician that is if you are rational and don't have much of an imagination.
Right, and this is an annual ritual. I mean, presidents have been doing this, back through the Clinton years.
Yeah, and it comes with a president that in a country whose non-white population is steadily growing is a huge role model for what is, you know, now you have children of every race, every background, every class background and so forth. You know, parents can tell those kids, study hard and you can grow up to be president, and they mean it. Mm-hmm. You know, because if somebody like Obama can do it, then somebody of any race can do it. You know, daughters can do it. You know, it really has broken down a lot of different barriers, and there really is an inspirational component here, regardless of what you think of Obama's politics. It's a completely non-ideological message. But this, of course, doesn't take into account the last great civil rights struggle of our time, which is equal rights for willfully ignorant people. the idea that you want to study hard and get an education as opposed to, you know, remaining misinformed throughout your life, it really is a form of soft bigotry, I think. That you know, we have to have equal rights for willfully ignorant people. And so the Bellevue School District yesterday announces that they are not going to let Obama's address be piped through to their school children, but that they are instead going to listen to the address, decide whether it is appropriately stripped of political content, and then parents have the option of letting their kids hear the address. Which is, you know, just craven caving to these conservative wingnuts who are screaming that Obama is going to indoctrinate children with his socialist agenda. it's madness. It is pure and simple madness. And so I have a modest proposal, which is that any school district, and this includes Bellevue, that is, so concerned about a non-ideological message from a president telling children to study hard and get an education that they don't believe that that message should be given to school children, they deserve to have their federal funding stripped from them. Not because the federal government doesn't have access to the school children for their ideological messages, but because they are so ignorant that they simply shouldn't be entrusted with educating our children.
I have a little bit of a different take on it. My feeling is that, you know, kids should be free of any messages from any political figures, and I think it's fine for parents to object to their kids having to sit and listen to any president, regardless of their ideology, give them a message. However, I also feel that this kind of move.
That's not where this is coming from, though.
Yeah, that's not where this is coming from, though. You know, these people aren't doing this for the same reasons I would be doing it for. I think this is all, I look at this all in the context of the right wing and even the mainstream of the Republican Party these days, having, you know, they're out for blood when it comes to Barack Obama. And I don't feel that this is coming from any kind of understanding of political reality. It's so divorced from political reality, some of the things these people are saying.
And it's divorced from ideology, too.
Yeah, it seems to be coming from a well of hatred and fear that I think is sparked by racism. That's the only way I can really understand this logically, or understand this in any kind of real terms, what is going on here. The fact that the Republican Party will not negotiate on any of the bills that the Democrats are introducing in Congress. I mean, you didn't even see that under Clinton. Sure, they vilified Clinton. They vilified him for his relationship with Monica Lewinsky, and that
long before that, too.
Yeah, well, and that gave some basis to you know, their witch hunt. But, you know, they didn't completely decide to not negotiate or not discuss any of the bills that were introduced. I just didn't see this kind of hatred of Clinton that they have of Barack Obama. And he hasn't done anything, really. You know, I just see it as absolute outright racism that is coming to this, that is kind of simmering to the surface here.
Yeah, they're even vilifying for policies that are basically continuations of the policies of the Bush administration.
Yeah, and
were just fine, you know, a year ago.
Yeah, and they're using a lot of red baiting terms, but the red baiting is ridiculous. Obama is no more socialist than, you know, any of the Democrats you've seen in the last 25 or 30 years, you know.
Which is not very socialist.
Yeah, which is not even close. So I have to put it down to just outright racism.
All right, moving on, the Seattle Times and healthcare coverage.
Yeah, you would never know this from the Seattle Times, but there were actually 3,000 people at Westlake on Thursday rallying in favor of healthcare reform. Apparently, however, you can't get coverage of people in favor of healthcare reform. Well, you can't get it at all. You can only get the loonies who are interrupting town halls and yelling against it. But the Seattle Times did, in fact, cover somebody who was in favor of healthcare reform on Friday. It just wasn't in Seattle. It was the guy who bit off part of somebody's finger at a rally in Los Angeles. So that makes news. But 3,000 concerned local citizens, headlined by the local congressman, Jim McDermott, with a number of other political figures in attendance, and, you know, with all sorts of concerned citizens, organized on very short notice, with a massive grassroots demonstration in favor of something that is an extremely topic and newsworthy topic. The Seattle Times does not care, and this is what happens when you have one newspaper in a town, and that newspaper is owned and run by an extremely conservative family.
Yeah, well, you know what we got to do, Job, if we want coverage of these kinds of events. We have to recruit somebody to go down there and get their finger bit off, at a
rally. No. You understand? The finger biter has to be somebody who is in favor of healthcare reform.
Oh, yes,
so,
that's right.
I think actually you'd be good at this. You could go down and bite somebody's finger off.
I'm not willing to do that.
Well, there is the rabies at risk, of course. But
yes. But
you see, the thing is, if a woman does it, it's even that much more newsworthy.
I think what we have to do is we have to go kidnap a Seattle Times reporter and bite their finger off. What do you think?
Oh, that's a plan.
Right. Moving on.
Okay, so we've got one action item coming out of this program.
Moving on, update on Jane Haig.
Yes, Jane DUI Haig, the county councilwoman who was reelected last year, despite first getting a DUI and then trying to cover up that fact, also was facing a lawsuit coming out of that campaign because her campaign labeled the supporter of opponent Richard Hope, put in a pamphlet that that supporter had at least, quote, had at least one assault conviction when that person in fact did not, and when in fact the Haig campaign apparently knew that this person did not have an assault conviction.
In other words, they lied.
So he sued for libel, and you would think that would be a pretty open and shut case. Well, apparently it was, because the jury came back and said, nope, it's not libel. What is the rationale behind this? The rationale was, first of all, the judge ruled that this person, because he had come out and publicly endorsed Richard Pope, who was the opponent, and it also commented on several local political blogs in favor of Richard Pope, was therefore a public figure. And as a public figure, the bar that you have to meet to prove libel is much higher, and that willfully lying about somebody does not meet with a malicious statement that harms that person's reputation does not meet those standards. So what this is basically is a ruling that says that if you're a political candidate and you want to say something outrageous and false about your opponent, they're fair game because, you know, they're a public figure.
Yeah. Well, I guess that means I should volunteer, since I'm a public figure. I should volunteer for abuse now. You can say anything,
Maria,
you want about me.
What you sign up for.
Oh, the head swims with possibilities.
All right. Let's move on to national and this week's economic news.
Yeah. No, we keep hearing the recession is over and that, you know, things are doing better. For example, that consumer spending is up. Well, early returns on retail sales in August seem to indicate that retail sales were down in August, down
despite back to school.
Yeah, a 3.6% decrease from a year ago. And yeah, you're right, Jav. This is the month when you usually see lots of back to school spending, most of it in sales of clothing and school supplies. Well, sales of clothing fell 6.6% last month, according to the research firm Retail Metrics, Inc. This is the 12th consecutive month of sales declines. So somebody explained to me how consumer spending can be up when retail sales are still going down.
Three words, cash for clunkers.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And,
which no longer
cash for clunkers is
operation.
Over.
Yeah.
Yeah. So also in the news this week was a little story that you could have easily missed, but it helps to explain why the housing market is doing better. Apparently, there are huge loan losses at the FHA, the Federal Housing Administration. It turns out that banks, when they tightened their lending standards and said, we will not give mortgage loans to people who have less than a 20% down payment, it turns out that the Federal Housing Administration stepped into the gap and they said, well, gosh, all these people who are risky loans who have as low as 3.5% for a down payment, we'll extend them a mortgage loan. We will insure their borrowing. Well, that has stabilized the housing market somewhat, and it's allowed a little bit of a recovery in the housing market this summer. However, the FHA, they now account for some 23% of the total mortgage market, up from 2.7% in 2006. So they've extended a lot of loans in the last 2 years. They also account for almost half of all new mortgages currently, but their losses are rising too, approaching the point where their reserves will now fall below the 2% floor mandated by Congress. In other words, they have to have enough cash on hand to cover 2% of the loans that they've insured, and they are beginning to fall below. They are at risk of falling below that 2% floor. So really, if we look at this in the aggregate, what we see is that the problem is that the FHA, you know, when banks in the last decade or so have lowered their lending standards, that's been a huge part of the crisis that was caused. The problem is the FHA didn't lower their lending standards until the last year or two, when they stepped into the gap and said, well, we will jump on the sinking ship too by doing what banks did but are no longer willing to do. And that's part of this whole idea that in order to save the economy, we have to roll the clock back to the way it was in 2005 and 2006, when there was easy credit for everybody, even people who couldn't make their payments and couldn't afford the properties they were buying. That's still going on. It's just, it's not big banks that are extending those loans anymore. It's taxpayers through the FHA.
Yeah, and again, this has been the intentional federal policy for the last year or two, is to try and resuscitate the good times, when those good times are by definition unsustainable, and it's a bad policy.
And it's the good times that have led to the really, really bad times we're having right now.
Yes. So rolling the clock back, is that like rolling the odometer back? It should just be made illegal.
It's just as deceptive, too.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, Job asked me a question right before we went on the air. He said, explain to me this idea of a jobless recovery. What is that? And I was telling him, you know, if you look at the last 20 years or so,
It's an oxymoron.
The two economic recoveries we've had, first the tech stock bubble. I'm talking about the tech stock bubble under the Clinton administration, the mid to late 90s, and then the housing market bubble, which is what we had under George Bush with the easing of credit. Those two bubbles were essentially jobless recoveries, too. They weren't real recoveries. They weren't, if you define recovery as lifting all boats, the term that means everybody from the poor on up to the rich see a little bit of increase in their income and a little bit of prosperity, not a lot for poor people, but a little bit of help, then that hasn't happened for more than 25 years or so, because during the tech stock bubble and the housing market recovery, the poor didn't do so well, and people who didn't have jobs didn't see a lot of employment. A lot of them were underemployed, and now those people are completely out of work. So a jobless recovery, they're starting to have to come up with a term to explain these bubbles, these things that are not real recoveries, and so they've come up with the term jobless recovery. It's a new term, but it's an old phenomenon.
All right. Moving on, Pfizer gets a day in court and a penalty this week.
Yeah, Pfizer just settled the largest healthcare fraud case in U.S. history by saying that they would pay a $2.3 billion settlement of civil and criminal charges that Pfizer and its subsidiary Farmacia and Upjohn illegally promoted four drugs for off-label uses and then paid kickbacks to doctors and other healthcare providers for prescribing those drugs. It turns out that Pfizer is a repeat offender. This is its fourth such settlement of government charges. You would think that this slap on the wrist should be a little bit harder for somebody who's a repeat offender, that at some point a company like that should be shut down, its license yanked, and its assets sold. Well, no, Pfizer, that's not going to happen to a major drug company like Pfizer. There's no three strikes, you're out for somebody like that.
And the amount of money that they have to pay in these kind of settlements is actually a drop in the bucket.
Literally a slap on the wrist.
Compared to the money that they're making by engaging in these deceptive practices.
Absolutely.
And that becomes an intentional strategy on the behalf, not just of Pfizer, but a lot of these large companies are looking at the calculation and figuring that the settlements and civil suits
part
and
their
regulatory settlements are part of the cost of doing business.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Exactly.
That just leaves a few minutes left to talk about Afghanistan.
Yeah. Well, we had... wait a minute. Was it NATO strike kills over 80 people, mostly civilians? Was that
this week
last week, or was it the week before, or was it the week before that? No, it actually, in this case, was this week. And this particular airstrike, unlike all of the others that have come before, one of the aspects that was particularly interesting about this one is that it occurred in a fairly remote area of northern Afghanistan, which is not where the Taliban has been traditionally strongest in this struggle, and which was until recently a relatively relatively peaceful area. The Taliban have moved into this area. Apparently there was a hijacked fuel tankers, and the tankers themselves were bombed, but they were bombed while a number of villagers and local area people were siphoning gasoline out of the tankers, and therefore they were killed. And this has been a recurring theme where the United States and NATO are launching these airstrikes and using air power and killing a lot of civilians. And yeah, in the short term, you might have killed a handful of Taliban fighters, but the damage that you do to your own cause and the number of fighters that the Taliban recruits from the families of those people, who civilians and previously neutral people who have been killed by these airstrikes, really undoes any good, even in military terms, let alone in humanitarian terms.
Yeah.
And this is how this war has been prosecuted for the last several years.
Yeah, and you know, this is the week when we've been hearing updates on the status of the war in Afghanistan, and it's come out that if you've been paying attention to these updates, it's come out that the Taliban now controls something like 2/3 of the country, including much of the north and west, where they never were, which is not a stronghold for them, and it's largely because we're supporting a corrupt narco state as the government of Afghanistan. And so McChrystal, General Stanley McChrystal, the head of U.S. command in Afghanistan, he wants more troops in the country to fight the Taliban. Obama's looking at the rising federal deficit and saying there's got to be a way to save money. Let's pull some of the non-combat troops out of Afghanistan and put in more private contractors, though I don't know how that's going to save any money. But then there's the issue, too, of how private contractors have helped to create major problems in Iraq. They're starting to do the same thing in Afghanistan.
Much poorer chain of command. Much poorer control, less accountability, less professionalism,
right,
and a much higher cost.
Right, and the Project on Government Oversight said this week that they're investigating complaints of lewd conduct, deviant behavior, and dangerous activities by private U.S. security guards working for Armor Group North America, which has a $180 million contract with the State Department to guard the U.S. Embassy in Kabul.
That sounds a lot like Abu Ghraib. Actually.
Yeah, exactly. Sounds exactly like Abu Ghraib. Currently, the Congressional Research Service says there are some 52,300 uniformed U.S. troops in Afghanistan, though that number is going up, and about 68,200 private contractors. So Obama wants to take that number even higher, even though that's the highest percentage of private contractor used in U.S. conflict in U.S. history.
Wasn't that something they were complaining about under Bush, that
that
we're relying more heavily on contractors and the Democrats
yes.
were going to change that? and when Maria talks about Afghanistan being a narco state, she's talking about people like Marshal Mohammad Qasim Fahim, who is the vice president now running while we're still waiting for election results from Afghanistan's election a few weeks ago. He is a statesman and also, according to the United States State Department, a high-volume heroin dealer. Or there's Abdul Rashim Dostum, who is a warlord who was brought back into the fold of Karzai, even though he is basically a war criminal. And has been such under the Northern Alliance and then in subsequent years for really the last 20 years. So it's an incredibly corrupt state, very closely tied to the heroin trade, and it doesn't have a lot of credibility among Afghans.
All right, events.
Couple of them to talk about. Monday is Labor's Labor Day celebration. That'll be at Lower Woodland Park Shelters on Monday, shelters 1 through 3. And then on Thursday, September 10th, Thomas Frank of What's the Matter of Kansas with Kansas has a new book out, Conservatives' Messy Legacy, talking about cleaning up after the Bush years. He'll be at Town Hall in Seattle, and that'll be at 7:30 on Thursday.
All right. Talking as we do every week, the Job Parish and Maria Tomczyk with Eat the State. And where do we find Eat the State?
Eat the State comes out every couple of weeks where you find free publications with local and national and international news and snark and, you know, we're opinionated. Let's leave it that way.
And yeah. We volunteer for abuse because we're public figures.
Yes. And we also try and get Satan elected mayor of Seattle because, well, you know. Why vote for the lesser evil? In any event, so it's also available on the web as well as you get free papers, bookstores, cafes, places like that. On the web, it's at www.eatthestate.org. And if you have questions, comments, tips, you have a finger that you don't really need, you can let us know. Our email is info@eatthestate.org.